The Dana Cortez Show podcast begins now.
All right, so welcome to the Dana Cortez Show with me, Dana Cortez, DJ Automatic, and Anthony A. It's United for Justice, a day of discussion, and it is an honor to introduce the 82nd, I believe. I think it was the 82nd Attorney General of the United States. Is that correct, Mr. Holder, Eric Holder?
That would be correct. 82.
My memory serves me well. I thought, oh my gosh, I didn't look that up. Okay, 82nd. So first of all, thank you for your time. I definitely appreciate that. This is a conversation that I think I would like to welcome the rest of the country to, because some of us have been talking about reforming our system from the justice system to just schools and places of work for a very long time. Now, after the death of George Floyd, there are cries all over America to defund the police. Now, depending on who you talk to, that could mean different things, from starting all over, or what I have discussed and what a lot of people that I've talked to say is really reallocating some of police's, you know, overbloated budget into communities of color. We're talking about access to health care, better education, mental health facilities. So how do you feel about defunding the police, Mr. Holder? And I read that you were selected to attend a private school for gifted students. So how do you think that helped you in your lifetime as well?
Well, just to correct the record, I was selected to go to a special program in a public school.
Oh, it was a public school. Okay. Okay, good.
I went from PS 127 in New York to PS 148. So I had a great public school education in the city of New York, and I'm proud of that. And I think we need to spend more money and more attention on our public schools. We can talk about charter schools. We can talk about private schools. The vast majority of our kids are going to end up in public schools, and we need to make them better than they have been, return them to the public school system that I knew, and support the teachers, make sure they have the adequate resources and the appropriate instruction. If we have a good public school system, we'll have really bright and wonderful and educated kids.
So what do you think about defunding the police? What do you think about reallocating some of that money into these impoverished communities?
Well, I think what I look for in this moment, after the death of George Floyd, is a reimagining of the way in which the police department, people in law enforcement, interact with the communities that they're supposed to serve. Certainly ask funding questions, but that really doesn't get to the heart of it. That thing, we can move money, but that's not going to change the dynamic that we need to change. We need to make sure that people in law enforcement are sensitive to the communities that they serve. Maybe we're asking the police to do too much, you know, sending police officers to answer calls that involve somebody who has a mental problem. I mean, why does a police officer have to deal with that?
Well, let me tell you why. Let me answer that, because there are no mental health facilities, and especially if you come from little or no means, there's nowhere else to turn. You can make calls,
wrong.
But if you don't have insurance,
that is wrong.
Exactly.
So we need to be putting more money into the mental health facilities to make sure. We have some sheriffs in this country who run the biggest mental health facilities in their states. That doesn't make any sense. You know, I understand before you all were born, back in the 80s, when we were in the, I guess back in the 80s, we were concerned about the condition in which the facilities in which people who had mental illnesses were housed. And we decided we wanted to close those facilities and put people out. And we ended up with a huge homeless population. And we've never come back and said, well, maybe that was wrong, and invest back in the mental health facilities or the mental health sector. It doesn't mean we have to reopen those bad facilities, but we certainly need to invest more. And we certainly don't need to have the police, I think, being involved in that part. Additionally, when we have minor crimes, somebody selling loose cigarettes, as Eric Garner was, or somebody is, I don't know, potentially passing, at least allegedly, a $20 check or $20 bogus bill, why do the police have to respond to that and end up in the situations that we were? So I think, as I said, reimagining what the police department does, and then asking questions about their budget. Is the budget too big? You know, I think in some ways we should be thinking about having like a peace dividend. We have crime rates that are historically low. Do we have police departments then that are dwindling their forces so that we don't need to have as many police, given the fact that the crime rate is as low? I mean, the crime rate in New York is now what it was back in the 1960s. Now, I wonder, how does the police department's budget compare now to what the budget was in 1960?
I just did some research and they're just growing. The budgets continue to grow despite crime going down. So you're right. You need to kind of rethink the way we deal with police. So you think police shouldn't be called when somebody is having a breakdown or some type of sort. There needs to be someone else or another place for them to go.
Yeah. I mean, I think we need to, you know, I think what you said earlier was exactly right. We, you know, we put a lot on the police department. We ask them to do a whole variety of things. You know, their core functions that they have to do, but these other things that they are called upon to do maybe ought to be done by other components in government that need to be enhanced. And some of the money that we spend on law enforcement needs to be reallocated so that we have experts, you know, experts. Police officers are trained in dealing with criminal things. I'm not sure the average cop is going to be equipped to deal with somebody who is in a mental health crisis. Have a person who's an expert respond to that kind of call.
Okay, well, I like that. I think without answering, you kind of support it, but not in the same way maybe that a lot of other people are speaking about it. Now, you know, during the Obama administration, you were America's top cop. Now that we're talking about reforming police, do you look back and think you could have done more on a federal level to hold local police departments accountable for rogue officers' actions? Mr. Holder, we see, you know, and the unions protect and both parties, you know, really support unions. And I support unions. But when you're not holding your own accountable, when these cops keep committing crimes, when you're the law and you're breaking the law, and then you get to move from job to job. Is there more that could have been done on a federal level or that can be done right now on a federal level?
Yeah. I mean, there are 18,000 police departments in the United States. The federal government really has, I think, a limited role in using its prosecution abilities to prosecute cops who do inappropriate things. But we're hampered. A federal government is hampered by the fact that the standard in the civil rights laws have a standard that's too high. It doesn't allow for the federal government to be a good backstop. The local governments are the ones that have to do things in the first instance. And one of the things that I said when I was attorney general was that that standard needs to be lowered. And that is part of the bill that Democrats in the House of Representatives have now put forward to lower that standard, which would allow the federal government to be more participatory when it comes to policing these cases. But accountability is clearly something that has to be a part of the mix. If police officers do something wrong, they have to be held accountable.
That's one thing I don't understand. How can you ask the police to police the police? I mean, I think there should just be a completely separate form of government that's actually looking over the police.
No, I think that you need to have, as they have, you now have in New York State, and you're now seeing in connection with the George Floyd case, you're having the attorney general, as opposed to the prosecutor who worked with the police officers in New York, you have the attorney general also doing so. I think, yeah, having some separation between the prosecutors who will try these kinds of cases and not having it be the prosecutors who on a routine basis work with the police officers, having a neutral prosecution team take over these cases. I think that makes a great deal of sense.
But why do these cops have 17 complaints? And this is one. Okay, I'm talking about the man who murdered George Floyd, former officer Chauvin. How can you have 17 complaints? I can't have 17 complaints where I work and keep my job. I can't have 3 complaints where I work and keep my job. Why do these officers continue to do these things and then they get laid off, they go to a new town, or maybe they just keep their job like this man did and nothing happens to them? Why are they not held to the same standard that everybody else is? I don't understand it.
Yeah, well, I mean, clearly those are systems that have to be fixed. You can't have people, as you say, have these multiple numbers of complaints and then continue to do the jobs, especially given all the power that they have. I mean, you know, police officers have the ability, as we have seen, to take life from people, to take property from people. And so, you know, the unions are a bit of a problem. There are, in the union contracts, you know, ways in which accountability and responsibility is too often kept away from police officers who engage in misconduct. And so that's got to be changed. And, you know, we have to, as again, the House Democrats have put together a program to have a national registry so that if, in fact, you are fired from a police department or you have a number of complaints put against you, that's put into a registry so that you don't can't bounce from one police department to another.
Well, I hope so. You know, there was just a terrible story. We talked about this automatic on the air. This man in San Antonio fed a feces sandwich to a homeless man, a cop. He got fired, but now he just got hired.
Just rehired him.
At another police department.
And no, they rehired him at San Antonio Police Department.
Oh, my gosh. So
think about that. That man did that. What kind of person does that to another human being? A bad person. And he's walking the street with a badge and a gun today.
Yeah, and that's the kind of thing that should disqualify that person for ever being, you know, a police officer. I mean, one of the things we also need to do is on the intake side, you know, to really test people to see whether or not they have the psychological makeup to be police officers. You know, not every person in the world has the necessary, you know, mental makeup, psychological makeup to be a police officer. And so I think, you know, really making sure that we test people as they come in to apply to be police officers to make sure that they have the right temperament, that they have the right outlook to make sure that they're going to be, you know, appropriately sensitive and fair in the use of the great power that we give to them.
And I'm glad you did say that, because I do also want to say that I know there are a lot of good cops out there, and I understand the danger they put themselves in every day when, you know, you hear the 911 call, so-and-so has a knife on the corner of whatever. They're the people responding. We need policing. We just need for the police to understand that this kind of conduct is just not acceptable. We pay their salaries. We deserve to be treated fairly. And that goes for everybody, regardless of your color or your background.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. You know, the majority of the cops that I've ever worked with or interacted with, you know, they're good police officers. They're trying to do their job as best they can. But that small number of cops who are not good ruin it for the good cops. And if they're not held accountable, then the good cops are seen in the same way that the bad ones are. And, you know, there has to be a breakdown of that protective thing that happens within within law enforcement, where people protect the good cops, protect those cops who do wrong, not understanding that they're putting themselves at greater risk. And so that culture needs to be changed as well.
I'm so glad you addressed that, because I just said this on the air. I said, if you have 100, you know, good cops and 10 are bad, but the rest aren't telling, they're all bad. I'm sorry. If you witness something that is a crime and you're not telling, you're bad, because you are assisting in that crime. And what happened to Mr. Floyd, in my opinion, those three officers were accessories to the crime. And I know they questioned it, but they did not step in, and they should have stepped in once that man said he couldn't breathe. Immediately, they should have stepped in. I don't even know why somebody put a knee on somebody's neck. I don't understand it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what ultimately will happen with those other three with regard to criminal liability, but their humanity should have somehow raised itself and said, you know, I think any of us would have said, you know, hey, whoa, hold on, man, stop doing that, you know, and forced the person who had his knee on the neck of Mr. George to stop that, you know, but they didn't.
Something that we talk about quite a bit, but I'm not sure that people understand it, Mr. Holder, gerrymandering. We hear a lot of politicians. I know it's something that you discuss. We hear a lot of politicians, activists discuss gerrymandering, but I don't know that everyone understands what gerrymandering is and how it affects elections, especially in communities that are brown and black or impoverished or both, all of the above. So can you please explain to everyone what gerrymandering is, and do you have a solution? Because in 2019, and I remember this, I did look this up before we went on the air, I remembered reading about this, the Supreme Court ruled that partisan redistricting is a political question and the courts can't judge if it's a violation of the Constitution. You look at these maps and it's just wild to me. Explain to everyone listening what gerrymandering is and how it affects communities of color.
Yeah, gerrymandering is when one party draws the lines, lines for city council, lines for state legislature, lines for the United States House of Representatives, draws them in such a way that you give yourself an unfair advantage over the party that you're running against. So you end up drawing these lines in such a way that you really pack, for instance, if Republicans are doing, you pack Democrats into one district so that their power is diluted with regard to other districts, or you spread Democrats around so that you diminish their power generally there. But it's a way in which you draw the lines to maximize your power while minimizing the power of the other side. And as a result, you end up with politicians picking their voters as opposed to voters choosing who their representatives are going to be. And then the politicians are not responsible to, they don't have to respond to the needs of their voters because they pick, you know, who their voters are. They respond more to the special interests as opposed to the people. And so if you care about criminal justice reform, if you care about the expansion of Medicaid, if you care about a woman's right to choose, these are all the kinds of things that we see too often around the country because of gerrymandering. You have state legislatures, again, that are totally gerrymandered, like Wisconsin, North Carolina, Florida, Texas. These are gerrymandered state legislatures that pass things that special interest groups want to have passed that might be inconsistent with what the people want to have. But because they're gerrymandered district, people in power can do these things and not get voted out of office. And so they keep doing what the special interests want to do as opposed to what the people want to do.
So what is the solution since the Supreme Court said it's out of our hands, basically? What can we do to change this? You're trying to elect different officials then, but you're telling me that it's already rigged against me. Is there a way to change this and really get on top of it? Because it's something we've talked about for a long time. And it seems that this has been going on too, really since the late 80s is when it started very quietly, the gerrymandering process.
Yeah. I mean, we've had gerrymandering in this country almost as long as we've had the United States of America. And both parties have done it. Republicans really gerrymandered in 2011 to a degree that Princeton University did a study and said it was the worst gerrymandering of the last 50 years. What is it we can do? Well, every 10 years after the census, the year after the census, we redistrict. We draw the lines at that point. So in 2010, we had the census. In 2011, we redistricted. Now we're going to have the census in 2020, which is important. Everybody fill out your census forms. And in 2021, we will redistrict again. And our organization, the National Democratic Redistricting Committee that I'm the chair of, is determined to make sure that the process in 2021 is fair. Doesn't gerrymander for Democrats, doesn't gerrymander for Republicans, just that we have a fair system. And so we have filed lawsuits. We have elected people who will stand for fair redistricting. We've also put in place commissions in different parts of the country, different states around the country. And these commissions are made up of neutral people who will draw the lines. Don't let politicians draw the lines at all. Let neutral people do it. And so people need to get out and vote. First of all, for people who will stand for fair redistricting, they have to fill out their census forms. That is obviously important as well.
Census.gov, by the way, census.gov. Go there now. It takes 4 minutes max for a family. We just did ours in under 4 minutes, so I'm sure a single person is even shorter.
Yeah, and now it's interesting what you said about that Supreme Court decision. Supreme Court said that the federal courts can't hear partisan gerrymandering cases, but they can still hear racial gerrymandering cases because sometimes you gerrymander on the basis of race, sometimes on the basis of politics. Supreme Court has said on the basis of politics, partisan gerrymandering, the federal courts are not open to those cases. And so what we have done at the NDRC is file lawsuits in state courts using the state constitutions and redrawn the lines that way. We've been successful in Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Virginia by filing for cases using the state system, using state courts, state judges, and the state constitution.
When are you going to get to Texas? My goodness.
Texas is one of our targets. We flipped 12 seats in 2018. We need to flip another 9 this year to take over the Texas House of Representatives. And that way, we will have Democrats at the table come 2021 when it comes to redistricting. The real danger is when one party controls the governor's seat as well as the two houses in the state legislature. It's called a trifecta. And they can therefore draw the lines in a way that favors their party. So Texas is one of our targets.
I had a question for you about the acting attorney general, Bill Barr, in particular to the comment he made that history is written by the winners when he was talking about General Flynn. Did you have anything to say about that, or you feel a certain way about him saying something like that?
Well, you know, I think Mr. Barr, I'm always reluctant to criticize my successors or even my predecessors. It's a tough job. But, you know, with him, he's he's exhausted my patience. History is not going to be kind to Bill Barr. He serves a president as opposed to serving the American people. An attorney general is supposed to be the lawyer for the people, not the lawyer for the president. And he has, you know, misconstrued facts. He's used put policies in place that are inconsistent with the traditions of the Justice Department, all to help and serve Donald Trump. He is among the worst attorneys general I think this nation's ever seen.
Tell us how you really feel.
Damn, just facts.
Yeah, you know, one thing I saw the President Obama town hall the other day, and one of the things that I found so hopeful was when he talked about, look, we've come a long way. You look at the protests today, they didn't look like that in the 60s. It's like, there's people of all colors out here. There's people fighting for justice for everyone. Is there a message of hope you'd like to deliver to anyone listening right now who feels hopeless and maybe stuck in a place that they want to get out of?
Yeah, you know, before every successful movement, there has to be that feeling of doubt, questions as to whether or not the movement will be successful. I'm sure Dr. King and, you know, Reverend Abernathy, John Lewis must have thought, at least at some point, can we really do this? Can we end segregation in this country? And yet, you know, they persevered, they suffered setbacks, and they were ultimately successful. And that's, I think, what we have to feel now. We have changed this nation in fundamental ways. We've ended slavery. We ended segregation. We made sure that women had the right to vote. We have been much better with regard to the LGBT community than we have in the past. All things that, you know, I mean, if you told somebody 10 years ago, we're going to have same-sex marriage, people would say, you're crazy. That can't possibly happen. And yet we do, because people fought for it. People committed themselves to it. People were dedicated towards it. You know, Dr. King said that the arc of the moral universe is long and it bends towards justice. But that only happens when dedicated people, citizens, average citizens, put their hands on that arc and pull it towards justice. If we do that again, if we do that right now, we can use this moment that through the death of George Floyd, we can make this a movement that will ultimately be successful and change this nation in ways that we can only begin to imagine. I'm really confident that if we stay focused and understand that positive change is not promised, it only happens when people work for it. If we commit ourselves to the work, we can change this nation for the better.
I feel it. You can feel it. It's different right now.
And I think that's absolutely right.
History's being made. Attorney General Eric Holder, thank you for your time. Thank you for joining us. A United for Justice, a day of discussion. This interview in its entirety is on YouTube. Search Dana Cortez Show. Same on Facebook, Dana Cortez Show, on Instagram, at Dana Cortez. Thank you so much, Attorney General Holder. Have a beautiful day. We thank you for your time.
Thank you.
The Dana Cortez Show podcast.
Hi, everyone. My name is Dana Cortez, host of The Dana Cortez Show. Now, we're about to enter into a Zoom conversation. This is United for Justice, a day of discussion. And I'm so excited to tell you Tom Joyner, the legend out of retirement, to join us in this conversation. Welcome to The Dana Cortez Show.
Thank you.
This is a conversation that I feel like I've been having for a very long time, being a Latina, a person of Mexican descent. I feel like the country has been having this conversation, but there's a different energy right now all over the world. It's not just here in America. And, you know, advancements have been made in regards to systemic racism. That is true. Life is better for me. Life is better for a lot of people. We can't deny that. But there's a lot more that can be done. And change comes sometimes from a place of anger because people get tired of just asking permission, asking and asking the same questions. I just want things to be fair. So what I want to ask you, Mr. Joyner, is what is one major difference in today than when you started radio many years ago?
I started during the civil rights era in the 60s. So that was a long time ago, and a lot of conversations, as you said, have been had about racism in America, and a lot of police brutality. Some of which I've had friends, personal friends, because like I said, I came up during the civil rights era. I protested with Dr. King. I marched, Selma, wow. Montgomery. Yeah. You know, I came up in a town called Tuskegee, which is full of a lot of black history. And protest was part of our everyday life growing up. I mean, every Saturday we were protesting something. Voter registration, lunch counter desegregation, churches, school, painting Confederate statues black. We did all that every Saturday. Every Saturday. And so as a kid, you know, I'm a teenager then. And me, my brother, all my friends, that's what we did on Saturdays. We were protesting something. One particular Saturday, we were protesting the fact that in our nearly all black town, the one radio station that we had didn't play any black music. No Aretha, no Temptations, no Wilson Pickett, none of that. It was a station meant to be played in the stores because all of the commerce was controlled by white people. It was apartheid. So all the commerce was controlled by white people, and they bought all the advertising. So all the music was like elevator music, background music. And so this particular Saturday, we were protesting the fact that the radio station didn't play any black music. The radio station was owned by the same person that owned a Ford car dealership. And it was inside the Ford car dealership where the studios were. And we were out there protesting. We want Aretha. We want the Temptations. One of the great things about a protest march back then, and I don't know about now, but I imagine it's probably the same. They fed you, and I was a fat kid, so I was not missing a protest march because those were some great sandwiches. Man, it was like a chicken sandwich was half a chicken.
They are feeding people at protests. They are giving out waters and all that. I'm not so sure the food is as good today as it was. I can't attest to that, Mr. Joyner, at all.
Oh, it was excellent.
But I can imagine. I have to follow up with the story you just told. Did you get the music played on the radio? Did they come to their senses?
And that was my first job in radio. Yeah, wow. The man came outside. He said, "You know what? I see y'all out here every Saturday protesting something. And I don't need this protest march in front of my Ford dealership. I don't care about this radio station. I really want to sell some cars. I don't need y'all out here protesting. I tell you what, it was a sun up to sundown station, and the owner said, I'll let y'all play all the Aretha and Temps y'all want on Saturday afternoon, starting at 12 noon till sundown, when the station signed off. And he said, which one of y'all protesters wants to do it? So in one hand, I had a picket sign. In the other hand, I had some chicken. I put the picket sign down. And I said, I'll do it. And that's how I got in the radio.
You didn't put the chicken sandwich down, though, did you?
Oh, no. That chicken sandwich was good. And I was a fat kid.
In that beautifully told tale, you've said so much about how America has changed from then till now. To think that there was a radio station that wouldn't play African Americans, black music in general, I don't know that radio could exist right now. Many places across the country without playing black artists. That's just that's a fact. We're on the stations we're on. It's 90% black artists. So in my mind, I can't even conceive of a radio station that doesn't play the music. It just doesn't, but that's how far we've come. So I think that that's a very positive story that you just told.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Universal Records says that they're banning the term urban as a music category. Do you think that this was the right step or just was something to appease people at the moment?
I remember when they changed it to urban. I was around then.
What did they call it before urban?
They call it black music. Oh. But the advertisers didn't want to be associated with black radio. And so radio came up with this term of urban. Urban radio, urban music, so that it didn't say black. It didn't fool anybody. Advertisers still didn't want to buy black radio. But they changed it to urban because they didn't want the term black, because they said that advertisers didn't want to be associated with black radio. And that's why black radio always made less money on ads than mainstream stations.
I almost feel like it's a move, kind of like you said, oh, we're going to call it urban music. You just explained, Mr. Joyner, what that is. I almost feel like it is an appeasement, right? Well, let's do away with this. But then what are you going to call the music? Why can't you just call it, you know, I don't know, hip hop or rhythmic or whatever? Why was it ever that in the first place? But now we know the history of that. I did not know that you were witness to them going from black music to urban. And so maybe they feel like it doesn't need to be called that. I mean, there shouldn't be a reason that advertisers don't spend money on, or spend no. less money rather on radio stations, like I said, that play black music. That would be most of the country. The most listened to music in the world is hip hop. And that is black music.
Yeah, it is. But you know, I always say, when you want to find the reason, when you want to find the reason for anything, follow the money. The money will always take you to a place of truth. You know, it's like the NFL and Roger Goodell apologizing. You know, why now? Why say we got it wrong and won't mention Cap's name? And that's really all about money. Roger Goodell doesn't give a damn. But right now, they need to sell some NFL tickets, you know, some season passes. That's what it's all about. I mean, those passes mean advertising dollars for the NFL. And advertising dollars pays the salaries. It's not the number of people that go to the games. It's the number of people that watch the games that makes the money for the NFL. And Roger Goodell and the NFL, they need to make some money. And the reason I think he didn't apologize to Cap is because of the settlement.
Right.
You know, they settled with Cap, and I don't think he could apologize. If he did apologize, then he'd have to admit that it was collusion and they settled. You know, he couldn't do that. So it's all about money. You know, now that the Justice Department and the government is stepping in with these different police municipalities and talking about taking their money and putting it somewhere else, now we're going to get some change.
The bottom line is, it's always the bottom line.
Yeah.
And I'm glad you brought up the police and all that, because there's this misconception when people say defund the police, people don't really understand that defund means to reallocate some of the money. Police departments have been growing, their finances have grown and grown, while communities of color see less and less money in that community, whether it's healthcare, schools, even mental health facilities. There's nowhere to go. If you have a person in your family who's suffering from mental illness, well, that's just too bad. That's why the homeless population has risen so much. School systems are suffering. People always say, oh, you know, just go to school and get an education. Well, that's not fair. If my neighborhood doesn't have the same school that your neighborhood does, I'm already starting behind.
Schools are run down.
Man.
You know, they're in bad shape. So yeah, take that money from the police and spend it on the communities. Okay. You're gonna get a difference in the police department now. Whenever you affect someone's money, oh, they'll change.
All of a sudden you get a lot of apologies. I saw NASCAR is banning the Confederate flag from all of their races for the first time. Why would they have allowed that flag to be present in the first place? Why now? Like you said, it's the bottom line. They need to sell tickets and they see that something's different. Something different happening right now.
There is something different happening right now. There's a different attitude. People see racism now where they didn't see it before. You know, they see it. And people have a conscience. And, you know, white people who fly the rebel flag and go to NASCAR, Now they're out there. They're out there protesting Black Lives Matter. It's amazing what this police officer that stood on the neck of George Floyd. And I wonder if he realizes the good that he's done for the world. You know, as he sits in jail, collecting all his GoFundMe money. I wonder if he realizes all the good that is going to come behind the murder of George Floyd.
I don't think he even grasps what's happening when, and I only could watch part of that video, Mr. Joyner. It's just very difficult to even talk about.
It is.
But for someone to be able to do that to another human being with a smirk on their face
and look around and see people filming him.
And the hands in their pocket. I wonder what kind of man he is when there's nobody filming him. What did he do before that even?
He had enough complaints. I think we know what he was doing. I mean, how many complaints did he have before
17.
This?
17 complaints. And I think he'd already shot somebody.
Yeah. And I think what the city council in Minneapolis is proposing to just disband the whole police department is the right thing to do.
They obviously have some problems there. I mean, from everything that happened with Philando in 2017 to now that their system is broken, I'm glad to see that they're trying to change it, and hopefully the rest of the country is going to follow suit.
Yeah, and I'm very positive that the rest of the country is.
Oh, yeah. I am too. Like you said, when I saw Roger Goodell apologize, I said, okay. When I saw NASCAR said no more Confederate flags, I said, okay.
Well, with NASCAR, they depend on ads. It's not just Confederate flag, but there's Tide and different oil companies. No one wants to be accused of being racist now. And so they don't want to be associated with anything that's racist. And NASCAR has been racist for so long with the Confederate flag as just a symbol of pride for all of the fans of NASCAR. So advertisers don't want to be associated with anything that's associated with the Confederate flag or Confederate statues. Again, follow the money.
You just talked about money. I always find it odd when people assume that if you're educated and black or brown, you face no racism at all. That's entirely wrong. So what's your message to someone who says, well, you're rich. Why are you complaining about racism, Mr. Joyner? Or why do you care about racism?
Well, because I didn't get rich without my culture helping me. So I have to care. If I don't care about my culture, then I'm not rich. Period. Again, I wouldn't make a dime if it wasn't for black people. So I'm black first. So everything that affects black people has affected me my entire life, my family, and their families. Yeah.
I think that's the most beautiful answer you could have given. Thank you so much for that. Is there any message? You've been a voice for the voiceless, Mr. Joyner, for decades, literally. Is there a message that you want to deliver today to them, to the people who've always followed you, and to somebody new who might be listening to your voice for the first time, who's looking for hope and a brighter future?
You know, stay woke, stay positive, keep protesting, and protest, protest, protest. Keep protesting. Protest until hell freezes over. And when hell freezes over, get some skates and keep protesting.
Mr. Joyner, thank you so much. Your career, on a personal note, has been something that I've watched. I'm the only Latina in the country with a syndicated morning show. And it's not for a lack of talent. Unfortunately, it's a lack of opportunity. So I'm very grateful to be also breaking some of these glass ceilings. And your career has been quite an inspiration for me to watch. So thank you for all you've done. And I appreciate this time that you've given us and the audience.
I picked a fine time to retire, didn't I?
You sure did.
Wow.
Thank you, sir. Have a great day. Love to your family. Love and light. Please stay safe and healthy.
All right. Be easy now.
All right, did we exit the Zoom call? Yes. Okay, thank you. I believe I'm still in shock right now that I just spoke to Tom Joyner. If you'd like to watch that conversation in its entirety, please go to our social media. If you're on Instagram, search at Dana Cortez. If you're on Facebook, Dana Cortez Show. And for all you YouTubers out there, remember, your kids are spending more and more time on YouTube. Be sure and monitor what they're watching. And then come watch our conversation with Tom Joyner. Subscribe to Dana Cortez Show on YouTube. United for Justice, a day of discussion. Thank you so much for listening.
The Dana Cortez Show Podcast.